myself sorted out. Can you hear me all right with this one? I move my hands around too much to hold the other one. I'll end up banging this with it. So, anyway, good morning. My name's Dave Lovell, if you don't know me, and I just want to thank Dave and Elise and Brett and Jen in their absence and the eldership team for inviting me to share. I kind of feel like I've been invited to a family dinner and asked to bless the meal. So I trust this is a blessing to you all, and I don't intend to specifically teach the meaning and the intricacies of the passage that we're going to share, but to simply share what God has laid on my heart through reading that word together. But Dave, I do know some scriptures, even if I ponder, and I'm pretty sure in Matthew there's one that says, "You shall not live by bread alone." So, but by every word, but I do appreciate the sentiment. As Jeremiah did say, though, I'm pretty sure in Jeremiah somewhere, it says, "I found your words and I ate them, and they filled me with gladness and joy." So I pray as we eat together this morning that God will fill you with his gladness and his joy. So we continue on at the table with meals that Jesus shared and attended and the occurrences around them as told in the Gospel of Luke. Last week, as you remember, we looked at Luke 11 and found Jesus reclining at the table. And in the midst of that recline, launches a broadside attack, as Dave so well described, on the Pharisees and the lawyers. And Dave exhorted us to search our own hearts, very much in the words of Psalm 139, where David calls out, "O God, know my heart. In truth, know my thoughts, and if any way you find in me that grieves you, then lead me otherwise in your way." Now, those guys knew those scriptures off by heart, verbatim. And yet, self-importance and the law of the time stood in the way of actually allowing the people of the land to commune with their God and know his heart for them. They just lived under a burden of law that was unreachable for them. But Jesus, as he came, fostered intimate and meaningful relationships with broken, hurting people. The people were rejected and separated by those conventions, and Jesus ached for them. Doesn't that remind you of the series we did last year on scandalous grace? And so as I read this story, which brings us now to Luke chapter 14. And reading from verses 1 to 24, surprisingly enough, we find Jesus again, after the debacle of last week, invited to dine with the Pharisees and lawyers again. Not just the Pharisees, but the ruler of the Pharisees. And it kind of reminds me, like, are these guys up for another round? How does that song go again, Rocky? Is it? You might know this one, yeah? So I think these guys were either resilient and they're up. All right, thanks, Rocky. So they're either arrogant or resilient. I don't know, but they were certainly up for another round. But, sorry, I got distracted. Let's get back to the passage, and I will look at it in three parts. And as we read through those parts together, I want to intersperse them with some stories of my own table experiences, and I'll lay them out for you to digest. So we read from the ESV, and it goes, "One Sabbath," starting at the beginning of 14, "one Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him carefully, and behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy. Jesus responded to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. Then Jesus took him and healed him and then sent him away. He said to them, "Which of you, having a son or an ox that has fallen into a well on the Sabbath day, will not immediately go and pull him out?" And they could not reply to these things. Now he told a parable to those who were invited, when he noticed how they chose the places of honor, and saying to them, "When you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not sit in the place of honor, lest someone come more distinguished than you, and then by who you are invited, you are moved to a lower place. But when you are invited, go and sit in the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, move up higher.' Then you will be honored, and in the presence of all who sit at the table. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." He then also said to the man who invited him, "When you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your neighbors, lest they may invite you in return, and then you're repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the just." When one of those who reclined at the table with him heard him say these things, he responded, "Blessed is everyone who will eat in the kingdom of heaven with God." But he said to him, "A man once had a great banquet and invited many. And at the time the banquet was ready," "said to those who were invited, 'Come, everything is ready now.' But they alike began to make excuses. The first said to him, 'I have bought a field and I must go and see it. Please have me excused.' And another said, 'I have bought 5 yoke of oxen and I go to examine them. Please have me excused.' And another said, 'I have married a wife and therefore I cannot come.' So the servant came and reported these things to the master. Then the master of the house became angry and said to the servant, 'Go out quickly to the streets and the lanes of the city and bring in the poor, the crippled and the blind and the lame.' And the servant said, 'Sir, what you have commanded has been done, and still there is room.' The master of the house said to the servant, 'Go out to the highways, the hedges, and compel people to come, that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those who were invited shall taste my banquet.'" A banquet is usually a meal of extravagance. And as Tim Keller put it, that is the very prodigal nature of God himself. But this meal was not a meal about the heart of God, but about self-importance. As we ponder what makes a good meal, is it extravagance? Is it the food? Is it the company? Is it the setting or the occasion? For you, what makes it special? Dave may have asked you this question already, but humour me, because I've been AWOL for good portions of this series. So if somebody wants to just interject and let me know what in this, don't want a story, Dave, just a simple what makes a meal memorable, important to you? No one? Thank you. The company, yes. The food itself, absolutely. The servant nature of it, that too. Thank you. For it can be a combination of all these things in conjunction with the occasion, the setting, the company, the food. For me, it is also the opportunities, if not missed, that arise around a meal. Opportunity to serve, opportunity to laugh, to include, to have conversation, to value, to celebrate. Jesus was the master of occasionem carpe, seizing the opportunity. What may cause us to miss opportunities? Sometimes just self-consciousness, sometimes fear, sometimes distraction, sometimes busyness, prejudgment, or just being tired. I've berated myself a number of times, but it reminded me of what Brett shared the other week about Martha and Mary. Just being distracted and missing the opportunity, either for ourselves or for others. In the first verses, there's an opportunity to show mercy, grace, and love. But the Pharisees miss it because they have a preconceived agenda. They were watching Jesus carefully, but not to learn from him, but to find fault in him. They were out to judge, but Jesus was about restorative justice. He heals the sick man. The Pharisees have no reply. I am guilty myself of prejudging an occasion. And if staying in that judgment, missing the heart of the occasion laid out before me, in this case, the meal, or even walking right past that table that's been set for me. Now, you've probably all been looking good on you, Rocky, looking at this photo that's been sitting up there. So I'll pause and just tell you a story. I want you to sort of inhale and get the smell of the bush with the heat on the eucalypts intermingled with pine resin and the smell of dust. And then you can add in two-stroke oil, petrol, and sweat. All right? This was one of my field trips that I worked with Training with Forestry up at Bathurst, and I took a number of my students up to work there. And it was to the end of 22. Last year I was taking a break from work, and these guys wanted to celebrate. And they said, "Dave, when will you go up? This is going to be the end of our training. You're going off, and let's have a meal. Let's have a barbecue." And I was like, like it's summer, like forestry's super strict about fire conditions and this and so on. And I said to them, "Look, we can't light a fire, and maybe if you just take up a..." And it's like, "Dave, we cannot, they're all good Lebanese. We cannot have a barbecue on gas. It has to be hot coals." And it's like, "Sorry, boys, we can't do it." Anyway, we rock up there, we get to there, and before we even started work, so we're there at dawn, two big Hiluxes, five burners on the back of each one, an esky with 10 kilos of the best halal meat, and plus everything else. And I'm so focused on like what work we've got to get done, we're finishing the day, so on, so on. And finally I relinquish and go, "Okay, we're never going to get any work done after we sit down to this meal, I know." So we came up with an arrangement, and we worked through, and then we stopped, and then we were going to have this meal. And oh my goodness. It does my heart good, because when I came back, beyond my expectation, the table was laid. Not the table you might expect, but the dirty tarp off the back of my ute. Still with oil on it from cleaning the chainsaws, but kebabs of chicken, lamb, kofta, beef, all the dressings, or hummus, baba ganoush, garlic, everything you can imagine and see laid out there. And all they wanted to do was celebrate in thanks. And the conversation, so we said thanks, they're good Muslim men. And we knelt down and we did wash our hands, Dave, and we began to eat. And the conversation turned to not what work I still thought we needed to get done, but what was more important, Dave. The mercy of Allah or his judgment. And that's how the meal went. It was amazing. And if I had been so focused on what I had to get done, I could have easily missed it. I went home in a food coma and needed three coffees to get back from Bathurst, but it was an amazing meal. From verse 7, we enter the second part of this passage. Jesus has been watching the room, the politicking, the manoeuvring, the self-importance, so far from his servant heart, it must have been awkward. He tells a story of a wedding feast with an underlined warning against self-exaltation. Verse 11 is the linchpin. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. When our point of reference is ourselves, we have no external measure and become easily threatened by circumstance or by perception that challenges our own self-image or our self-worth. But when we grasp that our person is anchored in the very image of God, our self-perspective becomes external, and we respond with a generous openness to life and others from a deep conviction of God's loving kindness, not my own importance. This is true spiritual humility. I want you to imagine another setting. This time, far away in the middle of Africa, with green rolling hills and dusty, sometimes wet, red, clayey roads. Villages dispersed remotely amongst the mountains. And it's Rwanda. And Wendy had worked there 10 years after the genocide for some years, just in restoration, in education and training. And through that, I had an opportunity to take a building team over there to work on another project. And it was a collective mix of people, that I took. Everybody, you know, when you travel, you have your own needs, your own comforts, your own way of sustaining yourself. And in the middle of Africa, that can be even harder. But anyway, so once we were at the building site, and we weren't the first to go, and people had talked to other people and so on. And so they knew that you could go to the Novotel bakery. You could stock up on good Western food. You could take it to the building site. You could sit down, and when you were hungry, you could eat your lunch. But I was like, no. We're going to eat with the local people. Because I'd been there before myself, and I'd met a lady, Rosie, carrying machete scars, but still able to smile. She had been an incredible cook and still was, but she lived in this village that we were going to be working, and she often cooked for the local people and the guys that travelled in there to help and labour. And I said to her, "Can you cook us a meal for lunch?" And so I had it all sorted out. Cost less than $1 each person to have this meal prepared in love. So our table is 4 plastic stools with a bit of wood laid on it to keep it off the dusty floor. She brings in pots steaming hot, opens them. It smells good, but looks unrecognizable to any Western eye of what you may be expecting to eat for lunch and sustain you the rest of that day. I had prepared, it wasn't like a real big surprise, but it was. Because as I said, we come into the unknown and we expect what we expect. But I encouraged them and they ate it. And it was difficult for many. But at the same time, I'd invited another young man that Wendy had met through the training, who had given his life to the Lord and had gathered around himself 6 other orphans, of which there was many in that country at that time. And he spoke to me and met me when I came to the airport and said, "Dave, can I bring these 6 to work on the building site with you just so that they can learn something?" And so anyway, they came. I told him they'd eat with us and I'd share food with them. And as we struggled to eat, Celestine goes, "Oh, Dave, for us to eat like this in our village, you would have to be a rich man." It cost me less than $1 a person. And yet it was difficult for those that I took to eat. But for them, it was a banquet of extravagance. A willingness to walk in humility opened our eyes to the world of those around us as we were there. As we heard and we listened and we shared, our eyes and our hearts were open to more than we could have otherwise seen or known. Because our perspective changes as we are humble ourselves before God. And it's an oh my goodness moment. It's like walking. You probably heard my young son Malachi. It's like walking with him, hand in hand. And anybody that walks with a young child, it's not a quick process. And it's like, Papa, he calls me Papa. Papa, look. Oh yeah, cool, it's good, let's keep going. But if I take the moment and I get down and I look from where he's looking and I see what he's seeing, it's like my eyes are open because I'm willing to stop and rest and see what other people see. And I love it. I'm often not in a hurry anymore, but I am often truly amazed at what he sees. Once Jesus had exalted the virtues of humility, he begins from verse 12 to address elitist attitudes. Sometimes what I may call spiritual entitlement. Like we like to bargain with God. We feel like I deserve this. Like I've given this much money into the box or the plate. I've spent my time doing ministry. How about I have this or that? Or it could be the pastor's parking space. Yeah, mate, I've seen the sign. You are not that disabled. But I would not take his parking spot because I know he's a very good shot. But in this addressing of these attitudes, Jesus suggests that next time the man that had invited him has a banquet, that they don't go on inviting those that make them feel good, those that are going to give them the leg up, those that are going to help them get the next promotion that they want. Jesus goes on, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame. Whoa, what an affront. These were the people that would have made these Pharisees unclean. I know I'm getting close to time, but it just made me think of last week. Can you imagine this? Unclean people at the banquet. The whole washing of hands debacle from the week before. It's like, oh, unclean person, wash my hands again. Sit down. Another unclean, oh, wash my hands, sit down again. It would be like having dinner with the most OCD person ever. Like, no offense, if you operate in that space, I've got a very, very good friend who is the most OCD. When we go away surfing, I'll share a room with him and my mates will come into the room on purpose just to move stuff around to see what happens. It's tough love. Sorry, I got distracted again. I'll get back to where I was. But back to inviting the outsiders to the banquet. Jesus suggests by doing this that we create a heavenly space. This invokes a self-righteous response from another guest. Oh, blessed are those who eat this meal in heaven. The underlying sentiment of this response is very telling and exhibits the very attitude of entitlement that Jesus was addressing, because these guys believed that their own elevated status, that they had an automatic place in the kingdom at the table. By inference, the unclean were thus because of their sin and would not be included. As we come to the end of this passage, Jesus counters this response with a banquet parable. Intention of the story, he warns the Pharisees and the lawyers that their fabricated importance and thinly veiled poor excuse for ignoring the call of God through Moses and the prophets to humble themselves before him, which they knew verbatim again, was going to cause them miss the party, and those they judged as unclean being celebrated and fed at the kingdom table. Mindsets of entitlement can so easily blind us to celebrating the fullness of God's heart for those around us. We can so easily walk past. One more quick story. I know my timekeeper's telling me, but Wendy and I laid our own table once on upturned backpacks sitting on an Indian station. Now, an Indian station is a microcosm of the cacophony of the whole nation, an assault to all your senses. And trains are always late. So we were sitting there for ages, but we bought some yellow cake and chai and we were just sitting there eating it. And I noticed a beggar, he'd been there for ages, but as we spread our little table, he was trying to say something to me. And his mouth was so dry and he was crippled and couldn't move. But I was interested to know what he was trying to say. So I wet my cake and I moved towards him and I sat and I physically put it in his mouth. And waited, and his mouth moistened and he began to make sounds. But then as I looked up, there would have been 30 plus men standing around looking down at me. And I'm going, oh my goodness, what have I done? But a man in his cleanest, whitest Brahmin garb and headdress steps forward and says to me, sir, he calls me sir. He goes, sir, why would you do this? For him, it was unthinkable that he would touch this person because they were unclean. Best outcome was that he invited Wendy and I to join him in his first class carriage the rest of the journey and explain why. It was a very interesting conversation, but I haven't got the time to go through that. But you do not have to be in India to have a mindset like that. All we have to do is have a sense of entitlement that misses the heart of God for those around us. Opportunity seen and taken with humility to extend a hand of mercy furthers the opportunity for those receiving this experience to experience the extravagance of God, even at first if they do not know it. Relinquishing self is the challenge of these parables, to live and respond in relationship. Then with relationship, experiencing the unbridled heart of God for belonging and for purpose. I've got one more story, but I'll keep it short. Wendy and I sponsored a program in Adam Boer in West Timor for some years. And I had an opportunity to go up there and visit a refugee camp where people had squandered for 10 years post the East Timorese conflict. They had nothing. They'd been in there for 10 years, as I said. And so we had a purpose in mind. We knew what we were going there for. We visited there in the day. Unfortunately, we didn't realise that all the men would be out trying to find whatever they could or try and scavenge and get work, and women were there chai mining, and they begged us. As we explained, come back and tell the community tonight. Come back and share with us the program. One person said, but we have nothing to offer you. And it's like, oh, it's fine. And then one another of the group said, well, here, take this, and just gave them what would have been a substantial amount of money in Indonesian rupiah for them. Anyway, we went back that night. It was changed. It was kerosene lamps, full and blazing. There was a chunk of wood with wood stubs around there covered in banana leaves with a whole Barbie Gooling, like, which is a baby roast pig, and bananas on the table and this and that. And I'm just going, my goodness, why? And my first response was like, why did you spend the money? And only us could sit there, and some of the elders, and everybody else stood around and watched us eat first. Awkward. But I'm going like, why did you do this? This isn't why I came. I came to tell you. I came to share this. And you spent all the money on doing this? Like,
And anyway, it was a great meal, let me share. But then I just, where are the women that I spoke? And I went round the back in the dark. Still breaks my heart with revelation, but I went round the back where the lanterns were. And there was a little cooking fire, and there was this dark tin lean-to full of 10 women smiling and dirty and cooking dirty cooking fire. But they were white teeth glowing in the dark. And they're saying thank you to me. And they're cooking and serving me. And I suddenly realized, outside of my own agenda, these people, that one moment, why they spent and they extravaganced such a banquet was for 10 years they had no purpose. This was their purpose, to serve and to cook and invite guests. Is that not the purpose of God's heart for the kingdom? And in that action of us eating and letting them serve, they felt a sense of their own purpose again. For 10 years they had no guests. They had no one to cook for. They had, oh my goodness, it broke my heart. But it made me realize what we can miss in not offering that to every person that we meet.
My eyes are blurry. God has prepared a table for all of us. The fare is abundant, and to fully feast on his extravagance. He has shown you, shown me what is good, and what he requires in attendance is to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for your time too.